Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:28 PM, that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is March 20th. Today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And of course, being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for as well. So what we need to think about is the secular bull market over? I think this is the big question. And I think the arguments for a case that it is over have never been stronger in the course of the last decade. So it's obviously something we need to pay particular attention to. And I'm going to try and answer it during the course of this broadcast. I would like to kick off with the dollar index, because I think this is about one of the best things we can look at to give us an idea of exactly what is going on. The US government has just announced that they have made over $500 billion available in the repo market, and that's significant. They are embarking on a $750 billion quantitative easing program, and that is probably only a first round. They're going to be sending $1,000 to every adult and $500 to every child in the country in a couple of weeks' time, by all accounts. And the dollar is still going up. Well, that's obviously just doesn't make a lot of sense. If they're printing that amount of money, then the fact that the dollar is rallying so intensely against a background where there are other currencies in the world that are not embarking on the same degree of assistance, then there must be something else going on. And I think what we can see is this is almost the only kind of comparison I can think of is like a tsunami, where if you're sitting on the beach and the tide suddenly rushes out, then it's time to get up and start running, because then the big wave is coming. That's what we saw in February. The dollar actually pulled back in a very sharp manner. It was the unwinding of carry trades. It was less about the strength of the dollar than it was really about the weak, or the strength of the euro. Sorry, so it was less about the weakness of the dollar than the strength in the euro. And the euro had rallied very impressively, going from 108 to about 115. But now it's collapsing. So the initial part of this problem was that you had unwinding of carry trades. That is one of the primary funding mechanisms for leveraged traders globally. So we saw it in the euro, and we saw it in the yen, this rapid period where those carry trades were being unwound. Now it's a complete opposite. We're seeing that the dollar is in fact very strong and these currencies are weakening substantially, but it's for a different reason. It's because having unwound the carry trades, then the big macro funds, they started selling bonds. So over the course of the last week or 10 days, bond prices in fact started coming down at exactly the same time that equity prices were coming down. So that's massive deleveraging. There was not just an unwinding of carry trades, but outright deleveraging. So I think that's rather significant as well. What we're therefore can conclude is it was a clear demand for dollars all over the world that is being priced into the strength in the dollar. The fact that the dollar unwound all of its decline in here today, but most particularly that the S&P 500 closed on the low of the day, is also noteworthy. It's generally the case that short sellers don't want to be short going into the weekend, because there is just too much room for big announcements to be made when the market is shut, and then they come in on Monday morning and their P&L is all over the place. So you typically get some unwinding of shorts in Friday afternoons. That didn't happen today. Or if it did, it happened earlier in the day, and then those trades got put back on as we approached the middle of the session, and the index closed right on the low of the day, and the dollar closed on the high of the day. But we did start to see some support coming through in the bond market, but that is probably more to do with buying of bonds by the Federal Reserve before we get a very significant plug of new supply coming in. One of the reasons why bond yields have typically risen during bouts of quantitative easing is because of the supply situation, that the Federal Reserve or other central banks may be buying the bonds, but the Treasury or the respective Treasury is issuing them at a more aggressive rate, and therefore yields tend to rise during quantitative easing. Now, when we look at the long end of the curve, this is something that we need to pay attention to. The 30-year bond got up to almost 2% in here this week. We've had a very meaningful move in the long bond. Now, the yield pulled back in here today. Now, if the yield moves on the 30-year, moves back above the 2% level, then that would be clear sign, or it would be a clear sign, that bond investors are becoming concerned about the solvency of the U.S. government, or the ability of the U.S. government to pay back their debts. And the fact that the dollar is so strong is perhaps moderating that concern in the short term. The dollar, of course, will not be strong indefinitely, but deleveraging will eventually run its course. We have to consider why we've had this massive deleveraging. It is highly likely that we've seen, or we are in the process of seeing, some very large fund going bust. And that is what is contributing to the very considerable volatility that we've had in markets generally. So now the big question is, what happens next? I think that it is very important to pay attention to where the epicenter of risk is in any crisis. And I do feel like a bit of a slow learner, but I think we are increasingly getting a better perspective of where the risks reside. And I think the risks reside in the corporate sector, and most particularly in the corporate bond market. The investment grade ETF, LQD, has pulled back in an incredibly aggressive manner over just the last few weeks. In fact, it has unwound all of the bull market since 2010, and done so in an incredibly dynamic manner. Now, part of the reason for that is because these companies that make up the ETF are right on the edge of the kinds of companies that are potentially going to be downgraded. And when we think about what is the rationale for downgrading companies, well, it's going to be that their balance sheets are impaired. A lot of these companies have been engaged in buybacks, and buybacks are going to become progressively less popular. Obviously, a company like Apple has been buying back its shares, but big technology companies like Google and Amazon and Facebook do not buy back their shares. Then we think about, well, the reason that big companies like Boeing have found themselves in such incredible trouble, it's not simply because their planes are falling out of the sky. It's because the company was denuded of capital because they spent so much money buying back their own shares and not investing in research and development. And by rushing through the development of the 737 MAX, they didn't re-engineer the fuselage, and that has caused innumerable problems. So Boeing informed the government this week that they are going to require a bailout, and not only for themselves, but for their supplier network as well. And because it is a systemically important company, and because they alone employ 160,000 people, and perhaps double, if not triple that, in terms of the company's supplier network, they're quite likely to be bailed out. So that's obviously a significant problem, and there is no real sign that it's over yet. So this has been a very clear example of a Type 3 top, and with ranging time and size and a failed upside break. But it's a poster child for how buybacks have stripped companies of the capital that they require to weather difficult environments. That's, I think, one of the biggest challenges, because something that has been very clear over the course of this bull market has been the absolute reliance of the equity market on buybacks. So that's, I think, one of the bigger questions that is being explored by the markets right now, that we've had this huge reliance on buybacks over the course of the last decade, and the chances are that that trend is now approaching its end. Well, if it is approaching its end, and it was representative of the vast majority of performance in the stock market over the course of the last decade, then that is something that we do need to pay attention to. Because when we look at the S&P 500 and focus more on the long-term charts, that during secular bull markets, the S&P 500 doesn't generally fall below the 1,000-day moving average, and as of today, it is more than 10% below it. So it could rally by 10% and still be in a bear market. This is a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. It is a type 2 top formation characteristic. So we need to consider, what are the characteristics of a type 2 top? It's the massive reaction against the prevailing trend. It's the very surprising downward dynamic that makes people sit up, pay attention. It certainly instills fear, because people have suddenly been stopped out. They're sitting in cash. It's the kind of time when emergency investment committee meetings are held. And it's a time when we think about what's really changed. And is there something that, is this a buying opportunity? And this is something that I've seen repeatedly over the course of the last week, has been almost everyone I've talked to has been talking about buying the dip, and where are the buying opportunities? How can I buy something? We've seen a big pullback. This is the opportunity I've been waiting for a decade, to buy following a big pullback. I wish I had bought in December of 2018. I missed that opportunity, so now I want to buy this one. Well, that reaction to this bull market pullback is quite predictable, because it's a type 2 topping characteristic. I've literally witnessed all of those responses in conversations with people from every walk of life, because when anyone ever hears that I work in the financial industry, then they obviously want to talk about the market. Everyone from the bank teller to the young guy working in the UPS store to the barber, they've all expressed the same sentiment. So have institutional investors, hedge fund managers, and I would say, you know, well-seasoned investors. Everyone is looking to buy the dip. And because there are enough people to buy the dip, the chances are we are likely to get a rebound. That's, I think, quite likely. But then you have the challenge that typically when we see a type 2 top formation, you get a period of right-hand extension, and then it breaks down again. So this problem that we have with the corporate bond market is by far more the most important point out there. Because in order for the stock market to march higher, to have a V-shaped recovery and then just keep going, well, there has to be a buyer. Somebody has to be the buyer of first and last resort. And during the course of this bull market, it has been buybacks. But companies now are seeing that they're in danger of being downgraded. Their revenues have evaporated because of the response to the coronavirus. And their balance sheets are in poor condition because of the leverage that's been taken on in order to feed that binge of buybacks over the course of the last decade. So if companies no longer have the wherewithal to buy, then it also helps to highlight the fact that buybacks are inherently cyclical. And companies generally end up buying the most shares at the top and the least shares at the bottom, despite the fact that that the bottom is where there's objective value. So we have certainly had this very big pullback. There was the potential last week that these indices could easily have found support in the region of their respective trend means. And we have not seen that with the S&P 500. We have not seen it with the transportation index. It has pulled back in a very profound manner, also completing a type 3 top formation with a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. The Russell 2000 has also pulled back in an incredibly dynamic manner. If we go over and look at what's happening in Europe, the FTSE 250 in the UK has also pulled back in an incredibly dynamic manner. The DAX index in Germany, which is also a total return index, has also pulled back in a very dynamic manner. So we have a lot of evidence of these massive reactions against the prevailing trend. It's equally true when we look at the Nikkei in Japan, when we look at India. India has been relatively unscathed, but it certainly has pulled back, going from 12,500 to 8,000 in the space of 4 weeks is an incredibly swift pullback. When we think about some of the other emerging markets, the Indonesian market has now also pulled back in a very violent manner. The Brazilian market has pulled back in a very violent manner as well to break its uptrend. And anyone who sees these kinds of retracements, where we've seen some indices and a large number of individual shares pulling back by 50%, then it obviously starts to create the buy the dip mentality. People think, well, golly, it's gone down by 50%. There is obviously the potential for a rebound in here. And the fact that the NASDAQ has been comparatively steady during that period of volatility is, I think, something that is helping to support that buy the dip mentality. Because the NASDAQ is one of the few indices that has not broken below its 1,000-day moving average. In fact, it hasn't pulled back to test it at any point in the course of the last decade, and this is about as close as it's ever got. So there is certainly the potential that the NASDAQ will continue to exhibit relative strength. And that concentration of it investor interest in what is typically referred to as large cap growth in the investment management sector, well, that is preserving a number of the funds and portfolios out there, that they have been more concentrated in the large cap growth than they have been in the wider market. So anyone who's had a big concentration in technology has generally outperformed. Well, there's a reason too why large cap growth segment, which is dominated by the mega cap technology sector, is outperforming. Well, a lot of them don't buy back their own shares and they're cash rich. And they don't have a heavy reliance on a retail network. That's particularly true of companies like Netflix or Microsoft. Obviously, Apple does buy back its own shares and has closed all of its stores, so they are going to have to accept a very significant pullback. But then if we look at, for example, Facebook, their entire business is virtual, and people are going to be spending more time on their phones when they're not specifically at work. There is absolutely no doubt that the coronavirus represents a very significant threat. So, jobless data came out this week, and well, of course, it comes out every week, and it's reported with a 2-week lag, and we've had a significant spike on the upside. So, that's a meaningful move. But the vast majority of people who lost their jobs would have experienced that in the last 10 days. So this is likely to ramp higher when it is next reported on the 26th, and even more so when it is reported on in the beginning of April. Now, when you have that number of people losing their job all at the same time, then it's very different to a hurricane, because we've had spikes in terms of joblessness from hurricanes before. That's generally what you get in terms of these big spikes in August. This is different to that because the knock-on effect is longer and it happens across the entire economy rather than just one city or one state. Well, that means then that the repercussions on unemployment are going to be even larger. And the consensus figure now for a contraction in growth in this quarter is going to be in the order of 10%. So a 10% economic contraction in a month is really a profound set of circumstances. We got a stay-at-home message from the mayor yesterday, telling us that the schools and all businesses are going to be shut until the middle of April. So that's an additional month on top of the week that has already been ordered. So that's a quarantine of 5 weeks, where very little economic activity is going to be taking place. And that is all happening against a background where the oil price collapsed. So I think it is the only way that we're going to come to a conclusion about the pattern of events and what exactly is creating this stress in the market is to have an understanding of the chain reaction that occurred when oil prices collapsed. We had macro hedge funds that have been accessing capital via banks, or they've been accessing repo capital via the banks, because the banks themselves have not been able to engage in some of the more bigger leveraged trades. So macro hedge funds have had it all to themselves for most of the last decade. They had then had a significant issue with liquidity when oil prices pulled back, and not least because it happened at the same time that the fear about the coronavirus was ramping up. So that started the margin calls. Then we had the fact that they had to sell whatever was not nailed down. So they sold corporate bonds, they sold equities, and they sold gold. And everything pulled back together. And because the dollar is still strong, then they are still under pressure. So I think the big question that people have been asking is, when is this problem going to end? Excuse me. So when is this problem going to end? Well, we could just look at the number of cases, but I don't believe that that is any longer going to be the root cause. When economic activity starts to pick back up, that will obviously be positive. But that is not what's causing the dollar funding problem that we have right now. It's because there are margin calls going out to the big macro hedge funds, and the banking sector is not lending to them. When we look at the quantity of money that is being taken down in repo over the course of the last 2 days, it has contracted meaningfully. So the banks are not borrowing the money, and they're not going into the repo market to take down the capital, because they have no intention of lending it out to the non-bank lenders. So this is very significant. There is the clear potential we're going to see some of the biggest hedge funds in the world blow up. And I believe that it is when they eventually do blow up and we see the measures being taken in place to create an orderly wind down, that's when we're going to see a bottom in the market. It's then going to we're going to see the move on to the question of fallen angels, because we have not yet really seen a slew of companies being downgraded into junk bond status. One thing that I think is particularly interesting, when we compare the performance of LQD, where it went from 135 to 105. So I think we can, you know, just back of the envelope math, it's not quite 30%, but it's not far off it either. Then we look at the pullback that until today had not been larger in the high yield energy sector, in the high yield, and that's, sorry, this, we'll come back to this in a sec. It's HYG is the high yield, and high yield had not pulled back to nearly the same extent as the corporate bond sector. Now, when we then look at the municipals sector, these have pulled back extraordinarily violently, and these are for the municipals that were already having difficulty paying their bills. So there is obviously clear potential that we're going to see some of the higher yielding municipals run out of money, because when there are no businesses moving, when businesses are going bust, it represents a loss of income. And that is at a time when they're still going to have to make payments in terms of wages. So there is the real potential that we're going to see some of in the municipals sector go bust as a result of the coronavirus. Then when we look at senior loans, there has been really very significant growth in this industry, and it is also now starting to come under pressure. Now, these are completely separate from what's going on in the equity market, but it's the equity market is taking its cue from what's going on in the bond market. And the connection between bonds and equities throughout the course of this decade has been buybacks. If companies are experiencing downgrades, then they are likely to have to stop paying their dividends and stop buying back their shares. And that means they have to trade on their individual merits. Well, that's a significant issue. The problem here is that the yield curve spread has been surging higher. the difference between the 10-year and the 2-year is now above 50 basis points. It's generally speaking, people tend to get bent out of shape when it originally goes inverted. But in fact, it is when it starts to surge through 50 basis points, we're on the front end of a recession. So it's now at 53 basis points and it is going up in a dynamic manner. We are on the front end of a recession. The fact that the jobless figures have broken their downtrend is also supportive of the view that we are on the front end of a recession. There is likely to be a very significant re-rating of the corporate sector. There is approximately $10 trillion in outstanding corporate debt, and the major banks are not engaged in making markets any longer because of the Volcker Rule. The big macro hedge funds are now experiencing significant margin calls and are seeing a number of their trades go bad, and that is also likely to have a deleterious effect on the shares. So from that perspective, we have to, I think, begin to consider that the temptation is to buy the dip, and that might even be right in the short term. There is likely to be a rebound at the first sign that we're going to have some easing coming through, and there is lots of easing in the works. So that's definitely something that we can pay attention to. But we're only at the beginning of the recession. We could be dealing with the coronavirus for the next few months. We're not really going to have an answer to that until there is massive and repeated testing rolled out. And that alone is probably going to take a couple of months. Once we get the testing network up and running, then we can start letting people go back to school and go back to work and go back outside and back to bars and restaurants and clubs and start the entire social engine moving again. By the time everyone gets back out of their house, we're probably all going to be so stir crazy that people are going to take to social interaction with abandon. But it's also likely to have profound effects on some of the trends that have been evolving for most of the last decade. It's going to exaggerate them. There is going to, and quite likely to be, a significant bout of bankruptcy coming through in the retail sector. There are going to be shopping malls, an increasing number of them do not open up again after the quarantine phase has ended. There are going to be a number of companies that run into trouble with their debt because it gets downgraded. Then it comes down to when their refinancing schedules, and that's going to be individual to each company, eventually come up. So that's an additional question for some of the corporate bond analysts, is to look at when are refinancing schedules going to put pressure on individual stocks. When we then think about the Dow Gold ratio, there is, I think, a rather significant factor that it has been one of the most reliable long-term arbiters of whether we're in a secular bull or bear market. Over the course of the last 100 years, it has never sustained a move below the 1,000-day moving average in a secular bull market. So this is either the end of a secular bull market, or it is an extraordinary set of circumstances that is the kind of once in a 100-year activity that we just don't have precedent for. So that's, I think, an important consideration, because the Dow Gold ratio has now broken down in a very significant manner. And this looks like a trend ending. Well, that also puts a hole in the long-term view that there was going to be about 35 years between each of the peaks, and that each of the peaks was higher than the last, because this is a lower high, it's a significantly lower high, and it's a very significant breakdown. And it was achieved simply by the gold price doing nothing. The gold price pulled back for 2 weeks and is still steady around the $1,500 area. The stock market, on the other hand, gave up 10,000 points, going from 30 to 20,000. And in fact, it finished out the week in the 19,000 handle. So we've had a very profound pullback. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't value that's being created. There is obviously value that has been created in this environment. When, for example, we look at some of the most exaggerated trends, I was looking at the performance of Fortress Transportation today, and it went from 22 to 6 in the space of 4 weeks. Well, of course, it invests in transportation infrastructure, and there is no transportation going on at the moment. So the company is currently trading on an estimated PE of less than 7, and it has a dividend yield of 17.5%. Now, we can just assume the dividend is going to evaporate, but it's not as if people are going to stop traveling indefinitely. So if their assets can be held onto during a period of extraordinary difficulty that could last 6 months, then the chances are that these are income-producing assets, and then they're going to recover eventually. So logically, we would have to think that in the absence of outright default, there is a recovery scenario. The bigger question is whether the low is in fact going to be at 7 or 5. And of course, that is going to be down to fundamentals and market conditions. But when we get these kinds of phenomenal pullbacks, then 75% on the downside is usually where we can at least assume that value is beginning to come back in. When we look at, for example, a company like Kraft Heinz, where there was a massive deleveraging, which started in 2017, where the intangible assets of the company were completely written off. Well, then we have to at least start to think about the fact that they have got free cash flow of about $2.7 billion on a market cap of $27 billion. So that's a 10% free cash flow yield. And that's significant. So it's not like we don't have value coming back in. It's that where people are willing to look for the value is probably not in the same place. Because I think where people are most active in looking for value is in the big technology companies. So Microsoft, for example, is right in the region of its 200-day moving average. And it accelerated to get up to those peaks just shy of $200. So this is a type 1 trend-ending characteristic. And there is absolutely no guarantee that it is going to stop declining here. One of the biggest challenges that these companies have in the provision of cloud services is that the risk is in the corporate sector, but it's not only in the listed corporate sector. The cost of startups, of starting up a new company, has collapsed over the course of the last decade because of the evolution of the cloud. Snap was the first company to successfully deploy the strategy, and they IPO'd in 2017, and they have at least demonstrated that you can survive by not developing your own back end, but farming out the entire process to companies like Microsoft and Google. Well, the problem is that when your business model is based upon paying out 50% of your revenues to the back-end provider, and then your revenues evaporate because of the coronavirus, well, that means that the cash burn takes off like a hare. And then you have to start thinking about how long are these companies going to survive. Well, Google has now posted a massive failed upside break. It is down at the lower side of the underlying range. It is oversold in the short term. Going from $1,500 to $1,000 is a 30% pullback. So we haven't had a 50% pullback, but the problem is that a number of these big cloud companies are wholly reliant for revenue growth on some of the large number of small companies that don't make any money. So when those small companies go bust, it is going to take a lump of cash out of the balance sheets of some of these extraordinarily large companies. In that regard, it's the evolution of the cloud as a data provision sector is a bit like a pyramid scheme, that it's reliant on hundreds of startups that don't make money, receiving cash from venture capitalists to fund their expansion and drive for market share. They suddenly don't have any money coming in. They're going to start going bust one by one. That is then going to put greater and greater pressure on these bigger companies. So that's a significant issue, because the NASDAQ is the go-to market for retail investors in particular, but for the vast majority of asset managers as well. Because the only way that you could have outperformed the wider market over the course of the last decade was to own technology. And that means that the vast majority of portfolios are heavy technology. And we are being set up with the credit conditions that we have at the moment, that despite the fact that they have got strong balance sheets, they don't buy back their own shares, they're founder-led, and they've got lots of cash, that is unlikely to insulate them wholly from the wider problems that are going on in the corporate sector. But what it does mean is that they're probably going to be buying opportunities when we do get a deeper pullback. And their valuations have contracted. It's been a while since Google traded at a PE below 20. I think that's one of the important points. Then when we look at Tesla, the share went from just under 1,000 to 400, bounced pretty impressively yesterday, and now it's likely to come back down and test the region of the trend mean and mess around for a pretty prolonged period. Even in the best case possible scenario that Tesla in fact survives, every single time the company has embarked upon a capital investment project, then they have seen their share range in an extremely volatile manner. Netflix should be benefiting from the fact that the vast majority of people are at home and binge-watching TV shows. But again, this is a company that is highly reliant on access to money. And if banks are no longer lending, then that does put a dent in Netflix's revenues. But the additional point is that when actors are not working, there are no new shows. So that's something else that we need to be aware of, that the TED spread has broken on the upside. And the last time it was trading above 1% was back in 2007. And generally speaking, when it is trading above 100 basis points, then we need to consider that it is tightness in the credit markets that is something where the real epicenter of risk is. When we look at the performance of a company like Wells Fargo, that share started going sideways in 2015, and then it broke down in an emphatic manner just 4 weeks ago. Wells Fargo has been one of the most aggressive in trying to pursue the business of the big hedge funds. So they are the ones making the margin call on some of these funds, and they may not get their money back. I think that's one of the biggest risks for a share like this. Of course, what's going on in Europe is worse. And the European banking sector is at a new low. It has halved from already low levels in the last 4 weeks. And considering the fact that the ECB is now back in an environment where they are engaged in quantitative easing, and governments in the region are starting to break their fiscal rules, German yields have popped on the upside, going from a negative 90 basis points to a negative 20 basis points. At the same time, we've seen that the yield on Italian debt has been contracting over the last 2 days because the ECB is buying those bonds. But the bigger picture is the coronavirus has the potential to be the catalyst to deliver upon pan-European bonds. And this is exactly the same thing that happened when the USA was formed, that the individual debts of the states were absorbed by the new sovereign, and then sovereign bonds were issued. And there is the potential that the response to the coronavirus, the fact that the insolvency, or the impending insolvency, of a country like in Italy, having a deleterious effect on the currency union, is going to force closer cohesion or the dissolution of the euro. Well, that's a good reason for thinking why the euro should be weaker. It's not simply that there is massive demand for dollars, but there is a strong reason why one should not be holding euros in this kind of environment. Now, if we start to play this a little bit forward, we're likely to have a default crisis. There are going to be a significant number of companies that have to be downgraded. It is likely that we're in a long-term capital management scenario where there are going to be a number of big funds are going to have to be unwound in an orderly manner. The lesson that was learned from Lehman Brothers is that it is much better to inject the capital and do an orderly unwind, like was done with long-term capital management, than simply to allow defaults to occur. So it's likely that there are going to be bailouts of some of these hedge funds. And that is going to play very badly on a political front. So I think that's one of the bigger questions here. Then we have to consider that bull markets generally end in enthusiasm, and bear markets end in depression. And we are just not at the depression phase. There are too many people that are still eager to buy the dip. We are increasingly coming close towards helicopter money. And once a country starts going down the route of helicopter money and printing money with absolutely no intention of ever paying it back, then we are moving towards increasingly inflation. Now, inflation is going to pop up somewhere, and that is not wholly predictable. But wheat prices have got base formation characteristics, and the price posted an upside weekly key reversal this week. Now, if we get upside follow through next week, then we have to conclude that this is a base formation and that we're likely to see additional upside. Bull markets in the price of bread leads to social unrest, and that's a global phenomenon. So that is something we need to be particularly alert to because it would forestall the potential for a recovery. So I think in the short term, we are very oversold. There is the potential we're going to get a bounce once the deleveraging from some of these under pressure hedge funds has run its course. We get a bounce, then people get somewhat more enthusiastic, but it's quite likely that we're going to get a retest of the lows. The extent to which the lows hold will be the arbiting or the clear arbiter between whether this is a medium-term correction or a significant long-term market top. The damage done to corporate balance sheets through the course of the last decade with the hollowing out of balance sheets because of options payments and share buybacks rather than investing in expansion and R&D is going to be fully exposed as a result of the slowdown from the coronavirus. How quickly we get back to work from that is obviously going to be an additional point, but the bigger question is the longer term ramifications of the official response to this, because if we get helicopter money, which is looking increasingly likely, then gold is still cheap. And it is certainly subject to volatility. It was overextended relative to the trend mean. It has come right back down to test it. There is the potential that we are going to see some additional ranging. In fact, considering the short-term overbought condition being replaced by a short-term oversold condition, it's likely that we're going to see some ranging and support building. But once inflation starts to take off, and the clear indication that that will be occurring is when the 30-year bond does sustain a move back above 2%. So it did not do it this week. But this was a very meaningful rebound on the yield. So we do have the potential for inflationary pressures if they decide to completely flog the purchasing power of fiat currencies to deal with the challenges that have arisen. So we're definitely in a much more risky environment. This is a more serious environment for the global economy than we've had in the last decade. And to not even begin to consider that we are potentially at a secular market top, particularly for the bond market, is I think would be a mistake. We have to at least consider that the response to the oil crash, the coronavirus, and the tightening credit conditions is likely to have a knock-on effect for the global economy. That is difficult to predict right now. That does not mean there isn't value. There certainly is value being created, and cash flows and the ability to lock in cash flows is something that will be prized, as will the march of technology. It's not as if technological innovation has stopped. In fact, the pace of technological innovation is likely to persist. We are likely to have a vaccine for the coronavirus within the year. And after that, we may have to get a vaccine once a year, but it will become an insignificant factor in terms of our economic lives. That suggests that, yes, we have uncertainties in the short term. It's not like it will be impossible to make money, even if we are in a more difficult environment. There will be sectors that perform, and there will be sectors that come out of this entire episode stronger. And within the next few months, we're going to see those that have been able to sustain their performance, have met the challenges have become front and center today and have prospered despite it. Those are the shares and sectors that will lead us up and out of this corrective phase, regardless of all other factors. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.